Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. Before we jump in, we want to thank the Cosmos community for their sponsorship in making this episode possible. There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit Cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Delphi's Clubhouse. Today, I'm really thrilled to have on quite the powerhouse of L2 scaling projects with a focus on rollups. I'm going to let everybody introduce themselves. We'll start in the top left and go through. But just a quick overview, we have on Ed from Offchain Labs. We have Eli from Starkware, Alex from Matter Labs, which is running ZK Sync. We have Liam and Mark from Optimism. And we also have my friend Ben Simon from the fund Mechanism. Eli, let's start with yourself. Why don't you give a quick, 15-30 second overview on just who you are, and then we'll go to Alex.
Yeah, first of all, this is my very first Clubhouse. I'm very excited. Eli Ben Sasson. I'm co-founder and president at Starkware. Starkware sits in Israel. We are a 45-man team doing L2s for using a technology called ZK Stark. Yeah, that's about us.
Awesome. Alex?
Hi, everyone. I am co-founder of Matter Labs and one of co-creators of ZK Sync, which is a protocol driven by zero-knowledge proofs to bring scalability to Ethereum in a trustless way.
That's awesome. Mark, what about yourself?
Hey, my name is Mark, and I'm a developer at Optimism. In the past, I've contributed to Handshake, and now I'm working on trying to scale Ethereum.
That's awesome. Liam, let's go with you next, and then we'll go back up to Ben. You're at Optimism, too.
Cool. Yep. I'm Liam. I've been working on Ethereum for a handful of years now. I'm co-founder of ETH Global, and I've also been working on a protocol called State Channels, which is a similar L2 scaling protocol. So yeah, generally trying to get Ethereum to scale and building the community.
Awesome. Ed, what about you?
I'm Ed Felton. I'm co-founder and chief scientist at Offchain Labs. We make Arbitrum, which is an optimistic rollup-based scaling solution for Ethereum. We'll talk a lot more about that. Obviously, I've spent a big part of my career as an academic and did a stint as a White House staffer as well.
Damn, that's awesome. Ben, what about you?
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Simon. I work at Mechanism Capital, which is a DeFi-focused crypto investment fund, and I've been really interested in rollups specifically over the past few months, so I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Awesome. So guys, we have a lot of projects to cover, short amount of time, so I'll try and keep it somewhat targeted in the questions, and I'm sure I'm going to mess a couple things up, given you guys are the experts here, so feel free to correct me wherever I'm wrong. Let's start a bit just with project overviews. We could keep this somewhat quick, but we have optimistic rollups, we have ZK rollups and Validium, and we also have ZK rollups. So I think we should start with the optimistic rollup side with Optimism and Arbitrum. Why don't we start with Liam and Mark from Optimism? Why don't you just give a quick overview of what optimistic rollups are and your approach, and then we'll go to Arbitrum.
Cool, sure, thanks. So basically the idea of an optimistic rollup is... it helps to, all rollups do this actually, but it's kind of just decoupling the execution from the consensus, right? So in an optimistic rollup, you make the transactions available and then you do all the execution off chain. And then in particular with an optimistic rollup, you make available the state routes, the execution, the results of the execution, and you make those available, and then anybody can pull in the transaction data that L1 had consensus over, and then can execute those transactions, and then basically compare the state routes that they executed off-chain, that they got by executing the transactions, to the state routes that were posted on-chain. So it's basically just a way to not need to do the execution on Ethereum L1.
Got it. Now, how does that differ versus Arbitrum? Because you guys are both doing optimistic rollups. I guess, what are the key differences between Arbitrum and Optimism? And I guess it's a question for both sides here, but let's throw it over to Ed to give his take.
Sure. The main difference, I think, is the main difference in the technology has to do with how fraud proofs work. That is, if somebody proposes a roll-up block and someone else believes it's not correct, how do you resolve that disagreement? And Optimism uses an approach where you re-execute one transaction that there's a dispute about, whereas Arbitrum uses an interactive protocol, a multi-round interactive protocol for resolving the dispute, that in which you subdivide, sort of recursively subdivide the dispute until it's a very small dispute, and then resolve that on chain. And I think most of the differences between the two systems follow from that difference in basic approach. That is implications for cost, that is implications for other things, which, you know, we can dig into more.
It's awesome. And I guess just throwing that back to Optimism, what do you guys see as the largest differences? Do you agree with that, or?
Yeah, I think Ed brought up a great point, kind of the differences in fraud proofs. I also think that there's some differences in kind of the VM. Optimism is really focused on staying as close to Ethereum as possible. We really want to be like an extension of Ethereum. We don't really want to develop an entire tech stack that is different. And then I think we have some different philosophies on kind of MEV and fair sequencing.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, of course.
For sure. Yeah. I think in terms of Ethereum compatibility, we're super focused on compatibility, and we've worked really hard to get as compatible as we can. And our architectural approach, I think, gives us a higher degree of compatibility with Ethereum. That's been one of our North Stars in our system. And I think if you compare side by side, what you'll see in terms of what are the points of incompatibility with like vanilla Ethereum, I think we come out pretty well. So, I would just encourage people to look at the chapter and verse of that and judge for yourself.
Yeah, no, for sure. Definitely going to get into compatibility a bit. I want to also open this up to obviously Alex and obviously the Starkware side. Why don't we switch over to Eli? Why don't you just give a brief overview of what you guys are doing compared to Optimistic Rollups, and then we'll go to Alex.
Okay. So we, I guess, both of us represent the sort of cryptographic proof side of things, or the validity proofs approach to scaling. So, both us and Optimistic Rollups want to solve the problems of scale. And for that, you need to move some things from L1 to L2. Now, the question is, if you want to base your security on L1, the question is now, how are you going to do it when most of the action is taking place on L2? And I guess the biggest difference between Optimistic Rollups, which are a form of fraud proofs, and the things called ZK Rollups, I'm saying called ZK Rollups because actually zero knowledge is a very mathematically well-defined object that most of the projects don't really deliver. So let's call it just validity proofs-based approach. The biggest difference is that in the validity-based approach, you may never put a state update that isn't valid. It's impossible cryptographically to do so. And what really happens is that there's more burden placed on the L2 nodes because they need to generate these proofs of validity, which are cryptographically and computationally quite expensive. But once they did that, these proofs are extremely scalable and can be verified in a logarithmic time. So you can have this exponential compression and verification of correctness. And that's basically the approach of validity proofs, also known as ZK rollups and Validium and things like that. So that's, optimistic versus ZK rollups. Now, within the ZK rollups, I'll describe what we've been doing, and Alex is going to share, what they're up to. So we started off by offering basically scalability to, we worked closely with a number of teams in offering them scalability solutions. Right now we already deployed 3 production systems, Diversify with spot trading, have been servicing them since June, DYDX, with margin trading for just over a week, and roughly at the same time we started servicing Immutable X with NFT minting and trading, also going pretty smoothly for over a week. And these 3 different systems are all based on on validity proofs. 2 of them are in something called Validium, the other one is in rollup mode. And we're putting a lot of our efforts on opening up these capabilities to anyone to, write their own smart contracts and basically get an Ethereum-like L2 based on validity proofs. In our case, those are Starks.
Excellent overview. And I have a couple of questions, but I want Alex to go in first too as well.
Sure. So I'll add something to the question of optimistic versus ZK rollups. I just want to give a user perspective what it gives you if you move to validity proofs. You get a couple of advantages. The obvious one is that your finality is reached much faster on Ethereum, because the moment you provide the proof, it's final and funds can be used. Like it's let's say some minutes versus longer period of 1 or 2 weeks for optimistic rollups. And the second biggest interesting thing is that you can, so Validium offers a lot of advantages on its own. I think it gives subjectively better security, but there is a similar thing in an optimistic world as Validium. So like there is an analog called Plasma where you put the data completely off chain. But what you cannot implement with fraud proofs is a construction called Volition, which Stackware pioneered, which is a combination of off-chain and on-chain proofs. And this is what we implement with architecture called ZK Porter. And it's very interesting because it gives you seamless interoperability between the Validium and the ZK rollup part with the different properties and the users can choose. And specifically on what we're doing with ZK Sync, we're currently building a ZK EVM solution, which will be launched as ZK Sync 2.0. ZK Sync 1.0 is live since summer last year for payments, and we want to extend it with generic programmability and launch this summer.
It's awesome. Thank you, Alex. And a lot to go through. Ben, I want to shoot it over to you because I know you probably have a great way to summarize this for some of our non-technical listeners.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I think getting into the weeds is really awesome, and it's really exciting for me to hear some of the differences and get into some of the technical sort of trade-offs between both, optimistic and ZK rollups, and then between optimistic rollups and between, types of ZK rollups. But just to maybe add a little bit of context and to situate this discussion in the broader discussion, broader context of framing, of scaling Ethereum. I think like ZK rollups and optimistic rollups both share some important properties. And I think, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of how they're different, but maybe it's just important to point out at the outset, how they're similar. So both ZK and optimistic rollups, I think, and rollups in general, this concept of rollups is really different from sort of other potential scaling solutions, namely like sidechains. Because rollups, what they are, as I think Mark alluded to at the beginning, but just to clarify some of the terminology, Mark said, I think rollups separate computation from sort of the data themselves and sort of from finality. So what that means, I guess, in non-technical terms is that everything that happens on a rollup chain, that itself isn't final. It's not final until it's included back on the Ethereum base chain. And so what that means is that rollups are inherently limited. They don't have the ability to sort of actually force acceptance of any transactions that are processed on rollups. And that limitation is actually a strength. It's really important because it means that anything that happens on rollup has this sort of review process in the case of optimistic rollups, or I guess in the case of ZK rollups, maybe this more instantaneous, if not fully instantaneous validation, cryptographic validation that happens on Ethereum. And so there's this like ability for the Ethereum base chain to overrule, I guess, in sort of this very crass metaphor, any transactions that are processed on rollups. And that's really important because that's not the case for other sort of scaling solutions like sidechains. And so this is, I think, why people are very excited about rollups, because they're set to inherit the sort of security properties of Ethereum consensus. They don't require their own sort of bootstrap, like this, you know, massive consensus network. They sort of tap into Ethereum security. And so that's just, I think, maybe I'm curious if any of the sort of technical experts would disagree with that framing. And maybe if so, that would help my understanding and potentially the understanding of all the listeners. But that's how I think about rollups in general. And I think, you know, a lot of the disagreements and the sort of technical differences are really important to get into. But, you know, just to sort of situate rollups vis-a-vis sort of everything else, that's how I'd look at things.
So I guess I would agree with most of that. I think there are some things to clarify, though, around the issues of finality on optimistic rollups, because it's true of Arbitrum, and I'll let the optimism folks speak for themselves on this, but that you get finality as quickly as in the other systems and as quickly as Ethereum. And the reason I say that is what you care about as a user in terms of finality is at what point in time is the result of your transaction fully determined, so that you know and everyone who is paying attention knows that your transaction will happen and exactly what the result will be. And in Arbitrum, that happens as quickly as on any of these other systems and as quickly as it does on Ethereum. So the only entity that doesn't find out about your transaction at sort of L1 finality speed or faster is the Ethereum chain itself, right? The whole point of a rollup is to make it so that the Ethereum chain doesn't have to follow every detail of every transaction. But as soon as your submission of your transaction for execution is recorded on the L1 chain, then your transaction has finality. Its result is guaranteed. And any one party in the world, including you, can force it to be correctly accepted by the system. So you do get fast finality on optimistic rollups. And literally, the only party that doesn't know what the result of your transaction is the Ethereum chain. It takes a little bit longer for the L1 chain to fully confirm the already final result of your transaction.
So I have a question to this. Do you see it as realistic that the users will be able to learn about their finality? Like, do you think that users of Arbitrum will be able to run the full nodes of Arbitrum? Because that would be a prerequisite for them to learn if their transaction is final or not.
So they either need to run a full node themselves, which is feasible, because you can run a full node on an ordinary computer. You could run it on a laptop. Or you need to do what most Ethereum users do, which is go through a full node that they trust. So we view this like Ethereum. We think a lot of users are going to use a full node that's run by somebody else. Anyone can run a full node. It's very reasonable to run it on any machine you have. So we're no better or worse than Ethereum. And I would note that if you're using some other system, like a ZK system that's built on top of Ethereum, you would need to run an Ethereum full node yourself to have the same level of confidence. So this is not a fundamentally different situation from what you have in other ZK or in the ZK or optimistic other systems.
Follow-up question. If you say that the full node will be runnable on an average consumer hardware, what scalability boost do we get then? Because if the hardware requirements are the same as for Ethereum node, then I would expect the same limitations at
I would say a couple things to that. Number one is that Ethereum is designed so that the nodes spend only a very small fraction of their time actually executing transactions. And whereas these nodes can be executing transactions all the time. And so you get a very substantial speed up from that right away. There are a bunch of things that you can do in terms of performance. Not all of which we're talking about yet in terms of our roadmap. But there's a lot you can do to accelerate the execution beyond what Ethereum can do by taking advantage of the engineering freedom you have in designing a system yourself.
So that comment that you made about Ethereum using less compute than it actually can, like an Ethereum node will target about 1/10 of its like max kind of capacity, just to prevent, say, like a denial of service attack in a transaction, where if someone figures out how to create a transaction that makes the execution 10 times more expensive than average, it won't be able to crash the entire network. So kind of having that buffer is an important feature in a node.
Makes sense. And guys, just to zoom out a bit, can somebody give a good overview of just the differences between fraud proofs and validity proofs? I know we're sort of backing up a bit, but it is quite a difference between the two setups.
Yeah, I can give a try. So the biggest difference is that in a fraud proof or an optimistic rollup, the system may be temporarily in an invalid position, because basically it says, the way the system works is that, you know, anyone can publish any update, suggested update to the state of the system, even one that may be invalid. And then what happens if someone does that is that, there'll be someone will raise a flag and there'll be some arbitration going on, and this is the way it will be resolved. That's how fraud proofs work, Arbitrum optimistic rollups. In validity proofs, which is what the ZK Sync and Starkware are doing, there are also others, Loopring and Hermes, the system can never be in a position that is invalid, because in order to move the state of the system to some new state, a proof must be provided. And the cryptography prevents anyone, even a malicious actor, from generating proofs for invalid transitions. That is the biggest difference. And then the way it breaks down is that if you look at sort of the workload, so in validity proofs, someone called the prover needs to run a very substantial computation to generate this proof. But then everyone else can sort of sit back and just verify something very quickly and succinctly and rest assured that everything's okay. In optimistic rollup, it's a little bit more of a fair load among everyone. So it really requires a lot of participants to be, you know, watching and viewing the system. And they all work pretty much the same amount of work. So there isn't this skewedness between one node running much harder and then the others working lower. This is a trade-off. You could view it either as a benefit or as a disadvantage, right? It may be actually helpful that someone is running a lot more for others to work less. Or you could say that, no, you want your system to be such that everyone is working equally hard.
So it comes down partly to the question of whether you prefer an approach where you have a bunch of people who are running full nodes. If people are running full nodes, they're doing the computation themselves and they know what is happening and they're sort of following along themselves, right? And what Ellie's describing, I think, is an approach where you have, which is a little more centralized, where you have a single entity that is doing more heavy lifting and is actually executing all of the transactions, but while other people are relying on these validity proofs. It kind of comes down to the question of whether you want to be doing proving or dealing with proving every time for every time someone proposes a transaction, does it have to come with the proof? Or I'm sorry, every time someone proposes an update to the state, or do you want to do the work of proving only in cases where there's actually a dispute among the parties? ZK-type systems proactively do a proof every time, whereas optimistic systems only bother with proving and dealing with disputes in cases where people actually disagree about what the result might be. And that's hence the name optimistic, right? It means that in the normal case, what happens is someone proposes a correct update and other people look at it and say, yeah, that's correct, and on you go. There's not on-chain proving or proof checking or any kind of dispute mechanism in the case where people are behaving according to their incentives.
Just to short, interesting observation that in a ZK proof system based on validity proofs, you actually have, like, from a different angle, you have much more decentralization because every transaction is verified by all Ethereum full nodes and not only by a small subset of them.
I wanted to briefly jump back to the fraud proofs that I was discussing. Just like an easy way that I think about it is, you know, for the prover in the sort of ZK rollup sense, there doesn't need to be these like referees that are also sort of monitoring the state of the rollup in the same sense, because you have this one party, this prover, that's doing all the heavy lifting, like Ellie was saying. In the case of fraud proofs, and, you know, Ed, Mark, Liam, correct me if I'm wrong, it's more like you have this, you know, at the outset, at least, you have a sequencer. And I know that, Mark, you mentioned Optimism and Arbitrum are probably going to be taking different philosophical routes, you know, down the line when it comes to what that sequencer is going to look like. But you have this, you potentially have a sequencer that's in charge with ordering the transactions and the processing on the sort of the optimistic rollup. Then you have all these other validators, these users that are sort of refereeing to see, okay, is this transaction, this batch of transactions that was just processed by the sequencer, are those valid? And those referees, these other validators, can potentially, you know, throw a flag to stick with a metaphor if they want to, and that triggers this dispute resolution protocol. Mark and Liam and Ed can talk about maybe the differences between the dispute resolution protocols. But that's exactly, you know, what happens when this dispute resolution protocol is triggered is some either the entire batch of transactions is run through the EVM, the Ethereum Virtual Machine, or some segment of it is run through. But that's sort of, you have this sort of refereeing system. That's how I think about the sort of fraud proofs. And I'd also add, you know, the optimistic name for optimistic rollups, it's named because of the fact that, you know, the rollup assumes sort of optimistically, it has this assumption that, you know, the transactions were valid until proven otherwise, like innocent until proven guilty, versus like ZK sort of guilty until proven innocent. You have this, like, sort of, you know, everything needs to meet this standard of cryptographic proof. But it's also, I think, optimistic. I'd say that the optimistic name might have even a different connotation too. This isn't necessarily intended, but it means that as long as there's one validator on the optimistic rollup that is sort of, that has integrity, that can sort of verify correctly the transactions, as long as you have one referee out of the entire network, then your network is going to be secure if that validator is like paying attention and keeping up and sort of submitting fraud proofs when necessary. You know, even if all the other validators on the network are corrupted, even if, you know, there's like a 51%, for example, in the case of a sidechain, that density doesn't matter in the case of an optimistic world, as long as there's just one that's able to submit, you know, challenges to whatever even sequencer or these other validators are submitting for processing. And I think that's a very powerful idea. You don't just have to corrupt 51% of the nodes like you do on like a normal blockchain. You have to actually corrupt like 100% of all the validators on an optimistic rollup, which is sort of a different level of security. And to add on to that, I mean, maybe Ed and Mark, maybe you can get into this, but it's also the case that because there are these transaction withdrawal delays, or I guess like Ed was saying, the sort of the finality comes on Ethereum later, theoretically, I mean, this is also a question that I've had, you know, isn't it possible for validators to come online if it looks like there's trouble with the sort of optimistic rollup network? You know, like, is there, you know, Vitalik has talked about the community being able to sort of mobilize if necessary. Is that true? Like, maybe you can get into that a little bit more, because this sort of one honest node is like a really important point, I think. And I know, Alex, you've also sort of been critical of that. So I'm just, you know, curious a little bit if you guys can dig into those assumptions.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Ed, you want to go first?
Yeah, let me just go very quickly. So the one honest node assumption is really important. And it's not only that one honest node guarantees safety, it's also that any honest node can force progress. And this is true because you don't need to have special high-end hardware or anything to function as a node in the system. Anyone can propose an update as well as disputing one that's wrong. And that means that you can offer a very strong guarantee of progress. Any one party can force correct progress and not just prevent a bad thing from happening.
But what would happen if the network splits and two parties propose progress in different directions?
There's a dispute between them. The dispute gets resolved and the one who's right will win.
But what if both are valid?
They can't both be valid. If they're both valid, then they're both correct. Then if they're both valid, then they're going to be the same.
No, well, they might contain different sets of transactions.
No, they don't. And this is actually pretty important about the way these systems work. So let me clear that up. the person proposing these blocks, these roll-up blocks, doesn't choose, at least in Arbitrum, they don't get to choose the order of inclusion of transactions. Ordering is happening by an L1 contract. So you submit your transaction to the chain by making a call to an L1 contract, or more likely a full node does that on your behalf to submit a batch of transactions. And so your transactions are put into order by an L1 contract that's running on Ethereum and therefore trustless. And all that happens on the chain and all that these proposed blocks or updates are doing is saying what are the correct results of the transactions that are already in order in the chain's inbox. So there's not an ability to select different transactions to run. It's not like a mempool. It's more like processing of a queue. And that means that there is a single deterministic correct result. And that's really important. That's how it is that you can have this finality as quickly as you can, because as soon as your transaction is recorded in the chain's inbox, then the result is fully determined and final. These block proposers are only proposing what is the correct result of a set of transactions that they don't get to choose.
Appreciate that, caller Ed and Mark, or sorry, Ed and Alex. And Mark, I think you want to jump in too.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start off talking a little bit about the fraud proofs, right? Because they need to be collateralized by a bond, because the execution, the fraud proof itself, is really expensive on L1. And you really want to create a fraud proof that is as cheap as possible to execute, because then the bond that is put down can be as small as possible. Because like the larger the bond, kind of the bigger the capital inefficiency there is. I do think that in the future, people that are really good at DeFi will figure out systems to kind of automate like moving around value, kind of using like the upcoming base fee opcode to be able to like know how much value needs to be collateralized at any given moment. And like something like Yearn could just kind of like move money in and out to make sure that the bond is always greater than the cost of the execution of the fraud proof. Because the idea is the user that submits the fraud proof, they have to pay all the gas for that fraud proof. But then in return, they get the bond. So unless it's worth their time, they're not going to be able to submit a fraud proof that secures the system. And there's a lot of concern around the idea of the fraud proofs being censored. Because let's say that there's 51% of the miners are all kind of colluding, and they decide to never build on blocks that include calls to the fraud proof contract. Then basically, you know, nobody will be able to submit a fraud proof. Now, I don't think that this is a problem for two reasons. One, there's this whole like, you know, you only need one verifier to be online to be able to submit the fraud proof. And you have 7 whole days to get that fraud proof in. So Optimism has a 7-day fraud proof window, meaning that just one fraud proof needs to get in over 7 days. So that would be a lot of money, basically constantly reorging out any blocks that call that have transactions that call the fraud proof contract. The idea is that the community can coordinate during those 7 days and kind of figure out what to do. Because at the end of the day, the Ethereum community is about like, you know, rough consensus, like outside of the code and kind of fixing things that way. The other thing is that I believe that miners, they will censor users that send fraud proofs because they will want to send the fraud proofs themselves. They will just include a zero gas price transaction directly in the block that is the fraud proof, and then they will just claim the money themselves.
Well, this is very interesting. If I may ask a couple of questions, I think that this is going to be the right couple of things here.
Yeah, sure.
So number one, you don't like the attack, which is hypothetically possible there, does not require an attacker to spend some ongoing costs the entire week. What they do is just make a plausible commitment and they say, we threaten to revert all the blocks which include this transaction. and they can show it, they can demonstrate that they have enough hash power, and this way they can force the miners into compliance, because the miners would be activists who lose money if they try to include the transaction, right? So the actual cost is much lower. And
the only way that would work is if the because all it takes is one miner to defect and include the fraud proof themselves. The reward.
No. It's not the case, because they.
Let's get real about this. If it were the case that it's cheap and easy to launch a 7-day censorship attack on Ethereum, that would be happening all the time now. It's possible to make, you could make a lot of money by attacking DeFi protocols, imposing 7-day delays on them. If this were so easy and so cheap and the community really wasn't going to respond to it, it'd be happening all the time now, but it's not. I think it's underestimates the resiliency of the Ethereum ecosystem, and it's just not consistent with the way that people use the system today. People today don't wait a week for finality on things.
So I think there has been a valid argument what prevents miners right now from doing this sort of 51% attack is that the community might respond, and the community response is like we see with the EAP 1559 and with parity multisig hug that it's actually very difficult to achieve a consensus on controversial topics. Like it's not as straightforward. We don't have the uniform community.
Well, why doesn't this attack happen all the time now? Why don't people?
There has been a really, really interesting argument. There has been one strong argument that it's actually not in the interests of miners. So first of all, it's very difficult to exploit any existing vulnerabilities in a very deterministic way, like in a straightforward way, unlike something like a fraud-proof system with a lot of value locked in it. Because like what you're gonna do? You're gonna speculate that the cost of maker will fall, and you have to short a lot of makers. So you need to provide a lot of capital, and so on and so on. It's like it's very complicated.
You're going to block Oracle updates. That's the attack.
Yeah.
If your argument is
but correct, how you exploit
all the time now?
No. Like you have to. You need some way to exploit it to make more money that you're gonna lose as a miner on the declining cost of Ether So that's very interesting. So this is an argument I can buy, that the miners have some vested interest in the ecosystem, and that's why they're not going to do
it, right?
Because it's going to harm them in the long term, unless there is no long term. So we all the miners know that we're going to transition to the proof of stake very soon, and it's actually. Sorry?
Why is this attack not happening now? There are easy ways to profit.
Because there is no straightforward way.
Block Oracle updates. That generates very easy price differences between the DeFi systems that rely on the Oracle updates and the outside markets. And then just exploit that price spread like crazy by letting only your own transactions in. It's an easy attack to do. It would be very profitable. And if you were correct about how easy this was to do, this would be happening all the time now, but it's not.
So that's what I'm saying. Right now, the miners have a lot of vested interest, but closer to the point where we're going to transition to proof of stake, this is not going to be the case.
So DeFi is going to be dead at that point?
I think that it's really hard to attack DeFi in this way. It's a lot easier to attack because you like to get this money out of the. To get the exploit money, you know, through like exchanges and everything, you're gonna lose significant portion of that. And
so the point
you
here,
lose the future.
Yeah. Okay. So the point here, though, is that this is not a thing that's about optimistic rollups. This is an issue with any system that relies on a finality period of less than a week.
I would disagree because there is a huge difference in how easy and straightforward it is to actually exploit the attack. Like if you do something which is very complicated and you have to do a lot of manipulation and you need a lot of capital to put there, that's one thing. If you just run something that gives you like $10 billion and it's just yours and then you can immediately use it, it's a very different thing.
I mean, they're market makers now. They have a ton of liquidity. This is their whole business, right? If anybody can cause a price spread between an Oracle-based DeFi market and the rest of the world, there's tons of arbitrage available. It's an easy attack. It's not happening. This has nothing to do with optimistic rollups. You're postulating that Ethereum is fundamentally broken, and it's just not.
I'd like to raise a different kind of I'll pose it as a question. I think it's an advantage of validity proofs over optimistic proofs, but I'd like to hear how optimism and Arbitrum are going to deal with such things. So here's the story. We went live with DYDX about a week and a half ago, and then there was just a few days ago, like a couple of days ago, April 17th, there was this 20% drop in prices of cryptocurrency, so DYDX is margin trading, and the reason that everything was handled very smoothly, in particular, our system handled over 1,000 liquidations in less than an hour, was because there's this very high resolution usage of Oracle price feeds that feed into the system. So what's going on here is that there's this very elaborate computation that, of course, you put on L2 because it would be too gas costly to put it on L1. And in particular, it wants to consume Oracle price feeds at a very high rate. Now, with a validity proof system, you do not need to put any of those price feeds or their signatures or anything on chain because you have a validity proof. This led us to settling, a liquidation cost us less than 6,000 gas. This happened 2 days ago. Now, if this would have been in an optimistic rollup, right, you need to put on the main chain at a very high rate all of the price feeds with their signatures for the system to have high resolution and allow large leveraging. So my question is, how do you plan to reach high scale with all of this auxiliary data that is needed? The signatures, the price feeds, and this, and all of that stuff. What are your plans, optimism and Arbitrum for allowing such things at high scale?
I think there are a couple of pieces to unpack here. One is the question of how any of these systems can support very fine-grained Oracle updates in a trustless way. Because the issue there is, how do you interleave these high-frequency Oracle updates with the trades or requests that come in from users, right? That goes to the question of how to do fair ordering and how to do it at a rate that is, I think you're postulating, much faster than the Ethereum block time. And that's a whole other side conversation. And there's no inherent advantage or disadvantage for any one system as far as that goes, as far as I can tell.
I disagree on that, but that's a separate point. I think with proofs you can have much better fare.
So what you're saying here is basically a statement about the size of digital signatures, or what is it exactly?
I'm giving a very practical situation that arose in our system 2 days ago, which is that there was this huge drop in prices. You want to have, correct liquidations for your customers. You want to use, in order for the system to allow very large leverage, you would like to have a high rate of updates of price feeds and their signatures. So in a validity proof system, you can have one proof that asserts that these price feeds were done correctly. I agree that there is a separate issue that we can get into. It's very interesting of how to do fair sequencing using validity proofs. But let's put it aside. Suppose you even have, Merkle commitments every block to the sequence of transactions, and you just want to prove that you process them. In an optimistic rollup, you're also going to need to use all of the information on the price feeds and process them. And that's just a lot of information. Practically, we were talking about hundreds of price feeds within a very small amount of time, and these are signed, and you want to compute the averages and so on and so forth. So that's a lot of information that needs to go into the process. And I'm wondering, how are you planning to deal with that?
Well, so I guess what I don't understand is why you postulate that the these Oracle feeds are going to be so large. Because it seems to me that they don't need to be so large. They can be encoded very efficiently. And all that needs to be put on chain is basically a compressed version of them, information sufficient to reconstruct what they were. And so there are some very obvious schemes around data compression and digital signatures that will solve this problem.
No, but how will you optimistically show that the liquidations were done at the right time at the right price if you compress the information? You know, if you took like the average over the past, the average and the variation or something like that, how are you going to prove, and there was this huge drop, how are you going to prove it? You need the full sequence. I mean, that's how we do it. We take the full sequence and we actually process it and, you know, do all the liquidations when they happen at the time. But, it doesn't appear on L1 because you can prove it.
Yeah, the answer is lossless compression. These things are very compressible. You don't need to sign every single update. You don't need to post a signature for every single update. You don't need to keep the full contents of every update. These things are super compressible if they are, and in a lossless way, if they are being done, if they're very frequent. This is an engineering problem. It's not a fundamental barrier to the deployment of these sorts of systems.
And the signatures, I mean, you need to suppose it always, like, over 5 minutes, every second, it just goes -1. So I agree you can have, you know, something that just says over the 5 minutes, it went down by -1. But each -1 needs to be signed, right? But by the Oracle feed. So and these are different signatures, and they have pretty much full entropy. So you're talking about a lot of signatures. What are your... You know, that cannot be compressed because these are cryptographic signatures.
So you chain the entries together and simply sign an accumulator. And that way, only the last accumulator needs to be posted. Again, this is an engineering problem. This is not a fundamental limitation of these systems.
No, I mean, one reaches the information theoretic lower bound of how much information is there. And that's what you need in optimistic rollups. And it's a theoretical limit. With validity proofs, you can go below that, right? You don't need the information theoretic information. You can go below that.
You have a different limit, right? All these systems have limits. There needs to be enough information posted on L1 so that people know what happened. And different systems have different engineering constraints. It's not the case that one type is dramatically more efficient than another type inherently.
No, it is the case. It is. I'm sorry, it is the case. I'll give another example. Suppose Alice and Bob, over an hour, just send back and forth with signatures a single payment, okay? A million of them, okay? Alice pays Bob, Bob pays Alice, Alice pays Bob, Bob pays Alice. In an optimistic rollup, in order for the system to work, you need to put a million signatures. It's an inherent thing. And with a ZK rollup, you do not. You can give one succinct proof that there were a million signatures, a sequence of them. They are fundamentally different. I mean, I think one is fundamentally better than the other. They're not the same.
Again, this is engineering, right? Aggregate.
No, it's theoretical. It's not engineering. Theoretically speaking.
BLS let you aggregate a large number of transactions together into a single signature.
It's not an engineering thing. No.
These limitations, these are not real limitations of these systems. It's just a question of which methods you use, right? If you support BLS signatures, then you only need one signature per batch of transactions, and the batches can be large. Signature overhead.
If Alice and Bob back and forth, I don't know which BLS signature you're using. No, I don't think. I'm not aware. Maybe there's something. No, I'm. You know, and it's not just. I'm telling a story that happened 2 days ago on a system in production. Mm-hmm. It's not. It is. There's a fundamental issue, And it is not just theoretical, it is also extremely practical, as I, you know, demonstrated 2 days ago. Now, I'm not saying there are a lot of things that are very good about optimistic rollups, but just saying that it's all the same is, you know, I don't buy that.
Let me try this again. All of these systems post a batch of transactions periodically, right?
Not necessarily, no. We do not, you know, in our systems in production now, we do not post a batch of transactions. No, we do not.
Post every transaction separately?
No, we don't post the transactions, period. In Validium, for instance, you do not post the transactions. And even in a rollup, you do not need to post the transactions. You just need to post the information that allows you to reconstruct the current state without posting the transactions. In particular, you do not post the price feeds. You do not post the signatures. You don't do that. It's not needed.
Right. So again, we're now veering off into this other discussion about whether you have data availability services that are off-chain.
No, you do not need data availability. No. You do not need data. It's not related to data availability, even in rollup. So, for instance, DYDX is a rollup mode. It does not require any data availability, and yet the individual transactions and the individual price feeds are not posted on the main chain. And the reason is an inherent one. It's not an engineering one. It is because in a validity proof, you do not need to provide all the nodes, all the information needed to check that the state transition was valid. You do not. It is inherently different.
How often?
It's not just an engineering, and it's not just a choice. These are validity proofs and fraud proofs are two very different technologies.
How often do you post a proof on chain?
Today with our systems?
Yes.
Every few hours currently. Basically, I just want to say our customers are the ones who tell us at what rate they want to post a proof. But it is their choice. Well, roughly once every few hours currently is the rate.
Okay. So if an optimistic rollup were posting a block every few hours, or a batch of transactions every few hours to make those transactions actually, the results of those transactions actually get finality, you would need one aggregated signature for each one of those several hour periods, right? You can use BLS signatures to aggregate all of the digital signatures on all of the transactions within that mega block. And that is one transaction with one signature, which is like 64 bytes every several hours, if you were to do it that way. It's just not a big overhead if you use signature aggregation.
Wait, what you are saying is that because in certain cases you do not want to post all of the witness as is needed, you are adding some external, some construction, for instance, aggregated signatures, which you can for the case of signatures, right? For other cases, you cannot. And in those cases, yes, you have it. I want to say that with validity proofs, you do not need to revert to that. You could add, you could have validity proof also over a BLS signature, but I'm saying you do not need that. Basically, if tomorrow there's some other computation that you cannot use aggregated signatures because, for instance, it's not about signatures. It's about something completely different. And it has actually a lot of entropy in it for all kinds of reasons. So you cannot compress it.
So,
In the case of a validity proof.
Right? You had this example about Alice and Bob generating transactions back and forth for 2 days. Right? I've explained how the overhead of that is very low.
May I try to point out what's the disagreement here is? I think I understand what's like. It's why we're talking about each other. So what Ellie says is, if you have 1,000 transactions that update a single variable, single storage slot.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Any 1,000 transactions can use aggregate signatures. That's the point, right? That's the point of BLS signatures. You can have many signatures made by different people, and you can aggregate them all into a single aggregate signature. So Alice,
but you, Alice and you, other people. I understand. I understand that. That's not.
Yes.
I get that. But then you still have to post 1,000 inputs for those transactions?
Compressed, yes. As do all of these systems. If you want
to actually... what do you mean compressed? Like you have to post 1,000 values of like price sheet update and one single VLS signature. Is that correct?
Compressed, yes. You can compress the...
What do you mean by...
Data compression is a standard engineering technique.
Okay, but it's still O of N, right? Like if you have 1,000 data points, then you have to put like 1,000
times. 1,000 bits, let's say.
No, but wait. First of all, you also have, if you compress, you know, you have 1,000 signatures, but you also want to post only the compressed information. I don't know what exactly this compressed is. You also need to somehow proof that the compressed information was signed by these 1,000 signatures, which, frankly, I don't know how to do within a BLS scheme unless you add to it some validity proof.
Engineer. Right? Engineer.
No, it's not just engineer. Look, I come from cryptography. I build systems that prove such things. It's not just engineering. There is no BLS signature that allows you to assert a computation. That thing is precisely called a proof, right? It's a different thing. A signature signs on data. A signature is not sufficient to show that a computation or a compression was done correctly. That thing is called a proof. It's a different creature.
Right.
It's a proof.
Here's
okay, good. So you could add, right, if you want to compress, you can add a proof. That's fine, right? But that's something extra. It's called the validity proof. And it's not just signatures.
Well, we've gone pretty far in the weeds here. Let me tell you what is true about Arbitrum. Arbitrum can post transactions as frequently as you want. It posts them at whatever pace users need in order to get finality. The data that is posted on chain is compressed. The system can support BLS signatures so that you have only one signature over a whole batch of transactions, no matter what those transactions are and no matter which parties put them in. This is all working today. And that's the situation. The decompression of that data, the verification of BLS signatures, that all happens in L2 computation. And so it's all covered by the optimistic rollup system. So this is a thing that works. Our code is open source. You can go look at it if you don't believe it exists. It's a little bit surreal to be sitting here and arguing about whether this is possible when we've actually built it.
I don't think anyone's really arguing whether or not it works. But I think maybe what I'd recommend, maybe Tom, Ben, if you want to try to let us zoom out a little bit here, because I think we're getting into like some insane level of detail.
Yeah, it's something
I don't think is mattering.
I think if I just can point, like, I think we can really succinctly show this problem because we've been discussing that and it's really interesting to come to a conclusion. So like in this example, if we have 1,000 feed updates, we would have to post 1,000 pieces of data on an optimistic rollup and just one piece of data on a validity proof system on a ZK rollup.
No,
1,000 versus
no.
one.
Guys, this was, I think we are gearing a little off into the, you know, I might need a PhD to understand it. The discussion and debate's obviously incredible, but maybe let's zoom out and redirect a little. Leo, I know you wanted to maybe jump in a bit.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I guess like the one area that I don't think we've covered much is less about, you know, the extreme detail of how these systems work, but more about how we're kind of progressing them into production in Ethereum. You know, I think it's great, for example, like Stark was talking about how, you know, DOIDX or Diversify has been running on it recently in production, and that's phenomenal. I think what maybe folks are more interested in is like, okay, how are we going to get to production specifically? And, you know, will Ethereum scale? What's the pathway going forward for the rest of the year? I think that would be more interesting to touch on.
Yeah, feel free to jump in. And I know we're getting to the 1:30 mark. So if anyone has to leave and is busy, feel free. If not, I'd love to keep going. But if you have to leave, no worries.
I'm going to say a few things just about autism, at least just my perspective on that question. Like Mark mentioned kind of at the onset of this whole discussion, what optimism is attempting to be is not like some new scaling business model or anything like that. We're trying to basically extend Ethereum. We see ourselves as members of the Ethereum community. And so in particular, the way that we're kind of approaching this whole situation is, you know, what's the minimum possible difference from the existing way that Ethereum
developers kind of consider building on Ethereum, that they can consider building on these sort of roll-up systems. So to that extent, the types of things we've done are make our sequencer not a brand new piece of software. We're just starting by diffing Geth, like literally just a diff on Geth. And similarly, the compiler of the Solidity compiler, we're doing a fork of that to make it so that you can compile down to the OVM, which is the sort of equivalent to the AVM on Arbitrum. But the point I'm making is that the way that we're approaching this is making it so that developers that are already in this ecosystem don't need to learn a brand new, set of fundamental new concepts. They can have a small diff from their existing knowledge of how Ethereum works to begin actually thinking about developing on optimistic rollups. That's the philosophical approach I think is really important to consider here. And I think that's the reason why, for example, a lot of people in the Ethereum community right now are very excited to be building on Optimism and are very excited to be, porting over their existing applications over to it because they can understand it. That's easier to kind of rock. So to that end, some things that we're doing are just very tiered approach where we're just finding great applications that work today that have developers on their team. So like Synthetics or Uniswap that already understand how applications in Ethereum could be developed with the existing Ethereum tech stack and kind of holding their hands to help them understand exactly how the OVM works so that they're feeling very comfortable deploying on it. Anyway, it's a lot of things there, but that's kind of like the philosophical approach. I'd love to hear others' approach.
No, Liam, that's an awesome way to zoom out. And guys, I just want to go in like a bit of a round robin, more of a rapid fire question kind of route. So, we'll start with Eli, we'll go Alex, Optimism, and then Ed and Ben, feel free to chime in or just ask the next question. But how are you guys thinking about just bootstrapping usage and adoption? Like obviously there's no tokens here, so it's tough to incentivize users to come. You more have to incentivize the developers to come. How do you do that? And how do you do it at scale?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. We grapple with it every day. And by the way, I want to say that on compatibility with Solidity, I think the other three projects are going to be compatible and have stated so. And actually, we're taking a different route. So it's even more challenging, right? We have this new funky Turing-complete language called Cairo. And, so the way we're going about it is we want every piece of what we're doing to be as immediately usable in production by real teams that demand it. So the very first thing we did was to get those teams that were willing to work and try out these systems and build them systems. This allowed us to hone the system and the demands from the programming language and integrate it with the SARCs and everything. And now we're sort of building on top of that and making it into something that would be an L2 with smart contracts and whatnot. But we're taking a different route than the other three teams here. And, if you want, we can discuss that. But that's my short answer.
No, that's really helpful.
Be as close as possible to production all the time. Make everything as useful as possible to real teams and real needs. That's our route.
That's helpful. Alex, what about you guys?
So I want to draw. And Liam is saying that we also build on the principles of Ethereum, and we want the sequencing to be an extension of Ethereum. And the way we think about it is just to embrace the existing ecosystem, the knowledge of the ecosystem. So our programming model is exactly the one as on Ethereum. We will support Solidity starting with sequencing 2.0, and we expect most contracts to just compile and most to just work out of the box. So we're following this path.
That's helpful, Alex.
And we're just going to offer a order of magnitude better experience from different angles on the cost side, on the finality to L1, so that users can withdraw immediately, especially on the cost side with the Zkey Porter approach, which I'm really, really super excited about. Because it's going to bring back users that who left Ethereum due to very high gas prices. And I think their roll-ups will not be able to alleviate the gas pressure like to a very high degree. So like the roll-up transactions are still going to be pretty expensive compared to what users have on like side chains or other ones. And we think that with this mixed approach, we can bring all those users back and let them seamlessly participate in the in the full Ethereum economy with ZK rollup on the other side, and all of that with EVM and with the tooling which people are used to, and with the same programming model.
Excellent. Thank you, Alex. Why don't we go to the optimism side, Mark and Liam? Or if they're out. Ed, I know you're ready to go.
Sure.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
I think, as everyone else has said, we're really focused on being a part of the Ethereum community, extending what's great about Ethereum. We've focused on being compatible not only at the technical level, but also in terms of how we build a community. So, but let me start with the technical level. We've worked really hard to be compatible with EVM, and that means that Arbitrum accepts EVM code directly and natively. You don't need to run a special compiler. You don't need to write in a special language. You don't need to rewrite your application. You can literally just push the very same bits that you would push to Ethereum to deploy a contract there, send those very same bits to an Arbitrum node, and you've deployed an Arbitrum. So that level of compatibility of running EVM code natively, you don't need to compile anything. You don't need to even download anything in order to work with Arbitrum. So that EVM compatibility and really sweating the details of getting all of the weird corner cases of EVM right. So being compatible with EVM, having our nodes use exactly the same RPC API that Ethereum nodes do, that sort of allows you to operate in a kind of drop-in compatible way. But beyond that, we've also really focused on building an ecosystem. And that means having our testnet when we started it about 6 months ago, and our mainnet when it comes soon, being fully open and public. Anyone can deploy to it. Anyone can use it. We don't pick a set of favorite projects to work with. We certainly work with people. We help people. But anyone who wants to deploy on Arbitrum, anyone who wants to use it can do that. That's been true from day one. We have literally thousands of contracts on our testnet. So that's been a really important part of it, that we want to be part of the community. We want to make sure that we have the services and the ecosystem fully built out there from day one. So when you see us launch, you'll see us launch with a robust ecosystem of not only applications, but also the kinds of services and compatibility with wallets and so on. This has been a big push for us, and a lot of our design and engineering has gone into supporting that.
Thanks so much, Ed.
And I'll just add one thing, actually, after, and then Mark can kind of chime in after. The thing that I want to really emphasize is not about, and this has come from learning of multiple years doing this, you know, Ethereum development and trying to contribute back into the community. The thing is not a matter of being compatible with EVM. Anyone can be compatible with the EVM. I think we're seeing lots of stuff that is, and I think that's great. The philosophical thing that's important is wanting to contribute upstream to Ethereum. You know, the version of the future that I personally want to see, and the reason why I'm personally working on this stuff, is one where Ethereum is scalable, not Ethereum scales via XYZ company. It's the one where we're merging in stuff that gets Ethereum itself to be scalable. So whether that's adding in EIPs to ensure stuff that all of our solutions benefit from, like reducing the cost of call data, or contributing to any governance of the Ethereum protocol itself, or trying to work really closely with the Geth team, with Solidity team, to get them to understand this stuff fundamentally. That's kind of, at least for me personally, that's where I come from. And I think it's worth just really taking kind of a thought about how we can give back to this technology that's enabled all of our businesses to exist in the first place. So that's I just want to emphasize that. That's what I'm trying to get across when it comes to contributing back and making the minimal diff and the contribution back to Ethereum. But I'll let Mark kind of keep chiming on further thoughts around building the community around optimism and whatnot.
Yeah, kind of like the longer term goal would be to try to get the actual sequencer code itself as a flag in Geth upstream, and then kind of just build this like critical mass of Ethereum developers that just by contributing to Ethereum, you're also contributing to, like, you know, optimistic Ethereum, because optimistic Ethereum just is like a newer kind of iteration of Ethereum. Because in the short term, in ETH2, there really is no execution. it's like kind of like the roll-up centered roadmap for the near future, where after the merge happens, so the merge is kind of planned very optimistically for the end of this year, or like pessimistically within like probably the first half of next year. So after this merge happens, you know, like since there's no execution in ETH2 yet, ETH2 is going to need rollups to be able to take advantage of the all of the extra data that is being agreed upon, all the extra consensus throughput. And, you know, we're trying to work really closely with Ethereum to make it as easy as possible to basically get Optimism running on ETH2, because we're trying to make the whole developer experience as close to Ethereum as possible. And ETH2 is promising that from the point of view of a developer, that there's not going to be many changes. You should be able to deploy your contracts in the exact same way. It should just like upgrade under the hood and just give way more throughput. And I think that you know, Optimism and other other rollups could be really key pieces in kind of bridging this gap in the short term and making ETH2 a lot more usable quicker.
Yeah, those are really interesting answers to Tom's question about bootstrapping, you know, your networks and thinking through your sort of goals in the near term and long term. I guess I'm curious, sort of as a user investor, just surveying the landscape of rollups and, you know, becoming ETH2. You've talked a lot about EVM compatibility, you know, what fraud proofs, validity proofs look like, their trade-offs, you know, withdrawal delay times, you know, how often you post batches back on Ethereum. So a lot of what you've been speaking about, I think, or what's been spoken about, has been sort of the relationship between Ethereum to these individual rollups. I'm curious if you could go into maybe a little bit more, and this is something that I guess we can stick with Tom's rapid fire round robin style question. But I guess if you can go into a little bit more, what cross chain, I guess cross L2, cross L1, not just sort of individual rollup to Ethereum, what that infrastructure is looking like, how you're planning on building it, and I guess, you know, maybe even at a sort of further layer of abstraction, and this is maybe a spicy, controversial question, but do you think the rollup sort of ecosystem is eventually going to be sort of a winner take all? Is it going to look like a winner take all? Is there a world in which, you know, zk-sync, Starkware, Arbitrum, Optimism are all functioning as their own sort of shards or rollups? I guess, I mean, in the ETH2 sense, or is it really going to be more of a winner take all race? I mean, I don't know if that's I'm curious, like, what each of you think from that perspective, or is there going to be a truly cross rollup world or a cross chain world from that perspective, or is it going to be maybe more concentrated because of liquidity?
Hey Ben, excellent question. Just quick for everyone, time check. We're going to close this out in 10 minutes, just to, you know, respect everyone's time. But excellent question by Ben. I guess we'll start with Ellie and go from there.
Yeah, I'll be very brief. I hope you know that there'll be a thriving a diverse set of L2s, and since they are all, you know, compatible with L1, so there are multiple ways in which they can converse, right? So that's what I hope will happen. I'm guessing, and this is certainly true for us now, we are right now, you know, we have so much work just focusing on getting our, you know, Starknet up and running. For us to think, you know, even connecting it to L1 is a lot of work. But definitely, I hope that the steady state will be many, many different L2s and rollups. There's room for all of them. You know, we need to take over all of the conventional world. You know, you need any scaling that you can get. Optimistic, validity, anything.
It's awesome, Alex.
So I actually think that there will be space for multiple different L2s to coexist. But what I think will happen is there will be a kind of a winner in each category. So like by category, I don't mean like optimistic or ZK rollups. Rather, like if you have a few L2 solutions which are like almost identical, then one of them will get the most network effects. But if you have two different layer two solutions, so different types, different technologies, different different properties, then you will probably have different users inclining towards one or the other. So I think with like if we have something like EVM compatible L2, whatever that is, like there will be a tendency towards like eventually one becoming the more used. And if this one becomes like actually so broadly used that it embraces like a very large part of the entire Ethereum ecosystem, it will probably at some point will be upmerged into Ethereum itself. So I agree with Liam on this. But if you have like EVM and Cairo and like some other approaches which are like entirely different, then I think they will live in their own niches.
It's really helpful. Let's switch over to Optimism. Mark and Liam, want to take that one?
Do you mind repeating the question real quick?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm happy to repeat it. I was generally asking about, you know, you were talking about Ethereum to individual rollup compatibility. That's sort of where a lot of the discussion and debate has been. But I was wondering more about cross rollup, cross L2, even maybe to also to other sidechains, to other L1s, generally like how you're thinking about compatibility with those, and also just the maybe the more controversial question about whether this rollup space in general is going to be winner take all, or whether there's going to be room for like sort of flourishing of all your solutions, or whether there's some in between answer there.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think there's space for many rollups. I think the key differentiating factors will be kind of governance and kind of like the uptime and the overall like trust that the community holds, like the people that are running the network. I think that given any sufficiently useful blockchain, I think that kind of like ARP bots or like, you know, MEV searchers will use up any extra gas that they can, just doing ARBs or whatever other sorts of like, you know, DeFi things that they do. So I could imagine a world where there's multiple rollups that kind of have different governance trade-offs. And I could imagine them all being generally at high capacity, just because they'll have a bunch of different, you know, apps deployed on them. And then all of their kind of unused gas will just get used up by our bots.
That's helpful. Ed, let's switch over to you.
Sure. Yeah. The first part of this interaction between chains, I think there's a bunch of interesting innovation happening there. People are trying out different methods. And I think over time, we'll have an increasingly robust set of methods for cross-chain coordination. The main event right now seems to be L2 to L1 interaction. That's the most immediate and pressing issue, I think, for most people. And there's a ton of great stuff happening there that can reduce the friction and so on in L1 to L2 interactions. And I think that will generalize over time to L2 to L2 interactions. So I'm pretty optimistic as far as that goes. As far as the question of sort of single chain future versus multi-chain future, you know, I think in the shorter term, I think each of these teams is probably focusing, I know we are, on building out a single chain that has a robust community on it. But then over time, I think a couple things will happen. One thing that will happen is that you'll see the more successful technologies making a transition to full community governance. And because that, I think, is a prerequisite for something having broad support over a longer period of time. And so the question of how things get governed and how you can eliminate points of centralization in these systems becomes more important over time. And the other thing that happens, I think, is that you see over time multiple roll-up chains, at least, going on. And with a tension between, on the one hand, the desire for people to be able to have synchronous composability and to take advantage of the network effect of being on the same rollup chain as other people. On the one hand, so that draws you toward wanting to be together. On the other hand, there's also a desire to decouple things that aren't really strongly connected to each other, that you can deal with issues around things like state growth, for example. By having things that are unrelated actually execute on different chains. And so you'll see probably a few big chains that are focused around different sectors or big applications, and then you'll see probably a longer tail of other chains. And as that cross-chain communication synchronization technology gets better, the cost of being on a different chain from someone else will gradually go down, not to zero, but to the point where I think you'll see a bunch of different chains operating over the longer term.
Makes a lot of sense, Ed. So guys, we're at about the 90-minute mark. This was incredible. It went way better than I expected. I mean, having four of the leading teams for L2 scaling on the roll-up side, I thought would be hard to do, but I really appreciate everyone's time and everyone being respectful. I'm definitely going to have to re-listen to this debate a couple times this weekend to really understand it myself, and I really appreciate everyone's time. And let's just go in a circle. We'll start with Eli again. Just tell everyone where they can follow you, the name of your project, just again to remind people for the audio side of things, to link to your voice again, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So the best way to follow us is to follow Starkware on Twitter. You can also follow me, Ellie Ben-Sasson, the same name as I have here. And I also retweet a lot of stuff from Starkware. You can also go to our website, starkware.co. And if you want, if you're a developer and want to learn the language in which our L2 is going to be operating in, so you can search for Cairo Lang or Cairo language. That's our programming language for giving you the scale, and that's the language in which we're building our systems. And Tom, a terrific episode, and thanks for Club. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks so much, Ellie. Alex?
You can easily find us on Twitter under ZKSync, just as it's spelled in the title of the room. You will find everything from there. And I want to thank Dom, and I want to thank all the participants here for a great discussion. It was on fire. I totally enjoyed that. Please share the link to the recording. We're going to share it everywhere. And also for building these great solutions, and no matter what's going to happen, the ecosystem will win. This is good for Ethereum. For amazing solutions being built by really, really smart, really diligent teams, can only mean that Ethereum is going to scale very soon. And the risks are very low here.
Thanks so much, Alex. Yeah, I agree. It's very hard to get bullish on competing L1 chains when they're going to run into the same scaling issues as ETH if they're decentralized, and they'll be right back here. And you guys are the ones leading the way. Mark and Liam from Optimism, you guys are up.
Yeah, go ahead. You can keep following Optimism if you just go to optimism.io. You can also follow on Twitter at OptimismPBC. It's like Public Benefit Corporation. Yeah, I encourage folks that are interested in hacking on Optimism. It's a hackathon going on right now called the Scaling Ethereum Hackathon. We can also see a bunch of hacks being worked on. There's talks and workshops and whatnot for Optimism and actually for all the other solutions on stage as well. So that's a great place to dive into more of the details. And finally, I'd also just say just generally if ways that you can contribute to Ethereum, whether that's going to the EIPs or ETH research. We're all over those things as well. And like I mentioned, trying to contribute to Ethereum, so you'll find us there too.
Thanks so much, guys. Ed, why don't we close out with you?
Sure. If you're a developer, you can go to developer.offchainlabs.com for documentation. General information about Arbitrum is at arbitrum.io. That's ARBITRUM. On Twitter, we are at Arbitrum. Let me add a plus one on the Scaling Ethereum Hackathon. We're there, and along with all these other teams, and it's a great way to see more about the community in operation. And I'd also say stay tuned for an announcement from us soon.
That's awesome. And Ben, just share a little bit about yourself, where people can follow you too.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It was great to be here with all of you. Clearly, I'm a bit of the odd one out because I'm not a founder of a roll-up protocol, but you can find me on Twitter at BenjaminSimon97. It's also the same handle that my Clubhouse handle. It's the same as my Clubhouse handle. So, yeah, really great talking with all of you. I learned a lot, and I'm looking forward to re-listening to this a couple of times, too.
Me, too. I'm really excited to re-listen. I have my weekend ahead of me. Thanks again, everyone. Hope to have everyone on again soon.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.